Welcome back. We are going to jump right into our conversation with Evan Grace and Brian Vollberg of Infinity Capital, where we left off.
All right. So when we had you guys last with us, we were talking about how you guys act as the quarterback for your clients, bringing in other professional advisors, CPAs, attorneys. I'd love to hear about how you guys, what role you play through the process.
Yeah, we're incredibly biased about finding apt advisors. We consider ourselves part of that group. But I think any business owner who's considering selling their business should first look to build the team. And that team includes typically an investment banker or a transaction advisor. Legal counsel is a huge aspect. And I would even dig deeper into legal counsel and say, attorneys are great. They are wildly intelligent on a number of different levels, but you want to find an attorney who specializes in transactions. The nuances of a purchase agreement and making sure the business owner understands what some of the terminology means, it's going to come across challenging or one-sided, and you have to be able to explain to the client, this is market, this is normal, here's how we should respond to something like this. So transaction attorneys are the ones we would typically lean towards. Doesn't mean other attorneys aren't capable, but the most efficient is going to be a transaction counsel of some kind. Other members of the team, so to speak, your CPA or tax advisor is really the last leg of that stool. Understanding what your basis is in your business, that's always the second question. What's the value, and then what's my take home? And structure obviously matters, but your tax advisor should be able to kind of give you an idea. Okay, hey, here's the cash you're receiving at closing. Here's what your balance sheet looks like. Here's what your sort of estimated taxes are. So deduct that from your purchase price, if you will. Pay your attorneys, pay your advisors, pay the government. Here's what you have left. So That is a challenging question. And so I'm sorry, tax counsel out there, if you start getting a lot of these questions, but it is one that, if you can sort of start to gauge on the front end and understand what that tax impact is, most buyers will try to structure in a way that's not unfavorable to a seller. LLCs can be difficult to, especially S-corps, can be difficult to buy on a stock basis. And so there's some different challenges and nuances of how businesses are structured and how they can be acquired. So back to the team, it's a huge piece of what we do, and we try to know our boundaries and our limits. And so, when we see a legal doc come across, there's business points, and we try to opine on the business points and leave legal to legal. We can really step in it if we start trying to give legal advice. So
we advocate, in some cases, slam our fist on the table for them to have the best counsel around them outside of Infinity. But we've just been in situations where attorneys have come in and they don't deal in transactions, and just it's really difficult for us to sit there when we see how it should be, or the client is just not even understanding the risk they're taking. We've learned our lesson the hard way on that. And so we advocate hard on the front end to have the best team around you. It may be more expensive. There's some loyalty with your attorney who handled your divorce or who handle the lawsuit, that you want specialists in this.
We could fully endorse that viewpoint. I mean, I've seen on the back end, of course, like what that net amount is. I've seen the tax savings in millions of dollars from a good transactional attorney. So I think that's so important.
That's the point we try to get across. It's really difficult to do that on the front end, because when you think of an attorney bill and you think my attorney bill is going to range somewhere between 50K and 200K.
Right.
It's a lot of money until you start putting relative dollars next to it and you say, okay, well, that money may save you $1 million. That's a good investment.
That's a good investment.
You spend the money on good counsel, you save your $1 million and you walk away. The problem is it's hard to objectively point and say, here's where you saved your money.
Right.
Here's where the value was added. And we deal with that too. Like Evan mentioned earlier, last episode, the working capital true-ups. A working capital peg can cost you $1 million. And if you don't know how to negotiate that, what it's being based on, it will be in your deal. If someone's not advising you what that looks like, then you stand to lose that trade. And so you've got to have competent advisors who can kind of coach you through it. And you may not objectively be able to point and say, well, I spent X and here's what I saved on it, but I promise you the value is there.
Right. And that's why experience is so important. And as you guys do more and more deals, as you mentioned, you've gotten better and better. And I imagine, thinking from an industry perspective, the more you do a deal in a transportation or oil and gas or whatever it is, the better prepared you'll be for the next client. Have you guys seen areas where you think you really excel, or you know, just locally in the market here? What's an area of focus for you guys?
I'd say we're generalists and mostly industry agnostic because we've done a couple of transactions in some very niche spaces. We go from one engagement in that space, we successfully complete it, to in this particular industry, we've got four engagements in this space, which has taken us outside of our core customer base in Oklahoma to the Southeast and Chicago. It opens the door. So I think the evolution will continue to see little subsets. Brian's led several deals in the healthcare space, so we've carved out a couple of niches. I don't think we'll ever not be a generalist firm. That's just because that's the lower middle market is so vast, and we'll always have that. We don't deal with oil and gas. We don't deal in real estate. We kind of stick to just the general.
Yeah, and industrials, manufacturing, yeah. Services. Our Rolodex of past clients looks a lot like what Oklahoma looks like from an industry perspective. And we will continue to gain, you know, traction and footing in specific industries that have led to more deals in that space. But a services deal is generally valued similarly to another services deal.
Right.
Distribution, same way. Manufacturing, same way. From a market standpoint and the way you run a process and who the buyers are, it's relatively the same, even though you may cross, you know, distribution for valves. We have a valve distributor right now who's going through a refinance. They sell midstream valves. You may also have a distributor who distributes components for aerospace. Those two things are totally different end markets, but the makeup of who's buying those, they're industrial distribution businesses. Right. And so mandates to buy industrial distribution businesses, we know who those people are, and so we go find them and source them, and the process is largely the same.
And some of that is a result of the private equity universe has gotten so big,
yeah,
that all these groups are now specializing and they're becoming more narrow in focus. Whereas 5 years ago, they may say, hey, we invest in industrials, and now it's, hey, we do very specific niche valves, pipes, fittings. That's our space that we operate in. I think we'll continue to see specialization on the private equity world, and we can kind of get into.
Yeah, I think this is a great time. That's certainly on my list. We look at private equity a lot, obviously, on our side as an investment. But I know with just the amount of money that's gone into the space, it's having effects on valuations. And there's just a lot of money out there looking for return, including our client dollars. So talk to us about how that's affected kind of your world.
And we've talked about this, the Mobison article that came out last year, which looked at all this.
Fantastic.
Such a great article.
The funds flowing into private equity. And there's a lot of good takeaways in that. Some of which we see on the front line. One of which is there's just a lot of money and a lot of appetite. That I think he focuses on both the number and dollars that are pursuing buyout strategies. So companies that raise money to buy majority equity in a company. When a private equity firm buys a business, they're not using all equity. They are borrowing money. Equity has increased in value, but the number of debt firms that have popped up to fill this need of, we want to lend money to private equity to buy companies. So you have these two, you know, massive trends of the number of debt funds being raised and dollar amount, the number of equity funds being raised. And then you just have some generational aspects of business owners who are of age where they have to transition. We benefit a lot from this just because there's so much money in private equity, and how it's benefited Infinity is that, I mean, I think it's gone, the Mobison, it started $50 billion in 1990 to assets under management to, it's probably $3 trillion now. So that's a 60x increase, where the lower middle market is now looked at as, hey, you know, a deal that's transacting at $2 billion has a lot of eyeballs, and it's, there's a lot of, historically would have been pursued. But the deal that's transacting at $10 million is now has, there's hundreds of groups out there who are saying, we want to invest in businesses doing $1 to $5 million EBITDA. Wow. So I think if you think of this as like water running, trickling down, it's trickled down in a big way to the lower middle market. And so we've benefited from that. And
at this point, is it a trickle or is it picking up more towards a stream at this point?
I think it's a stream. And COVID highlighted some of this, where the interrelatedness of the debt availability in equity dollars,
yep,
because COVID, you know, the private equity was still there and they still have to deploy it. What you saw in COVID was the debt market pulled back a bit just because of the uncertainty. And also no one woke up, you know, April 15th 2020 and said, now's the time to sell my business. So you had kind of, so because of that, M&A market stalled a bit, and you're seeing that come back. But yeah, it's a stream. It has impacted valuations, but I think that's a little overextended, that it's not gone from 2x to 20x. There's right. still, if you're in the lower middle market, you know, the average deal has probably gone up 20 or 30% each year, which is significant, but it's not, there's not so much money, because they're all kind of finding the spots where they're going in, that they're still smart investors on the side. And the Mobison article talked about how private equity has beat public, because right. private equity is buying at discount, and right. they've been disciplined, and the dispersion between the good private equity investors and the bad one, that's real. And that's yeah. something that we see on the front line. We deal with some really smart people that would be successful in any aspect that they do. And we also see kind of just some run the mill. They raise money because there's so much money
right.
that's chasing it.
So you'd say it's a seller's market from a business owner's perspective, but there's still enough return in these investments for the buyers that it makes sense for someone like us investing in the private equity space.
That is largely true. I think the other aspect, I think, to what we're talking about valuations is really it's increased the number of eyeballs looking at any given deal. So that drives competition. So that can drive pricing. I mean, that's just supply and demand. But as much as anything, it puts, you know, more educated minds trying to find a way to build value in a business. So I think a key aspect here is private equity still has to get a return, or buyers. Right. We say private equity, we're sort of focused on that. It could be a public company. It could be just a run-of-the-mill strategic buyer. A lot of times when a seller is selling the business, they're not selling 100% of the business. The buyers are saying, hey, we'd like you to roll 20% of your equity into the new business. It de-risks for us. It keeps you involved. It aligns incentives. All of those things. Buyers have discovered that that's the best way to sort of, you know, de-risk their investment. But what it does is it leaves an interesting opportunity for sellers to roll money into an investment that is largely a private equity vehicle, where private equity is not really available to, you know, the retail investor. It's right. hard. I can't just go up mm-hmm. to a firm and say, hey, take some money of mine and invest it in your new fund. You got to have yeah. scale.
Yep.
And so this is an opportunity to sort of have an a la carte investment in a business that private equity is doing 5 streams of diligence: financial, operational, benefits, insurance, environmental. They are underwriting this thing to the nth degree and going through an investment committee. They're managing other people's money. They've got to put a return out. So as a business owner selling, you have an opportunity to roll into that investment typically on equal terms and equal footing with the private equity firm. If they're out chasing 20% IRR over a 5-year period, it's not necessarily a bad place to put your money. They do still have to make money, but it does create some opportunities for sellers to continue to invest in a business in what we call 2 bites of the apple,
right.
which is take some money off the table, sell 75% of the business, roll 25%, let private equity or the new managers do their thing. That money is at risk. It can go to zero. It could be a dud of an investment, but a lot of times the goal is to, you know, return another liquidity event, you know, on par with your first one. So that's an aspect that some sellers are foreign to at first until they kind of get into, you know, the deal.
And not every buyer is just bringing dollars. Some of them are bringing operational mm-hmm. expertise
right.
or an operating partner that grew a larger business and sold to a public, you know,
right.
they're bringing expertise. And we've found often that, you know, our sellers are excited about the prospect. It takes a certain how you build the company. What's the saying? What gets you here won't get you there.
Right.
Yep.
That most of the time our clients are founder run. They have a shell of a management team, maybe a CFO, but these private equity groups are going to use best practices from their other hundreds of investments and experience they have. So our clients are surprisingly excited about rolling 20 or 30%. Sometimes the conversation starts at 15% and there's kind of a partnership element and dynamic
right.
that blossoms, and they end up rolling more than that.
We've mostly talked about, you know, equity acquisition so far. One thing we're actually looking at on our side is investing in funds that do some middle market lending. I know you guys are involved on the debt side as well. If a owner of a business wants some, you know, growth capital and they don't want to sell equity, they can go tap the debt markets. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, we mostly do sell side M&A. We're representing sellers who are selling, but we do several deals a year that's focused on this, where often kind of a progression is a client goes to their bank and bank says no for whatever reason. Banks have boxes, regulatory driven. We all get that. But because of all of this money that's been raised on a macro level, there's been pockets of people say, hey, I know that the risk profile can fit. We can price in a little more risk. And so cash flow lending, which is basically says we don't care what the asset profile is. We care what the cash flow, the EBITDA that's being produced. A lot of money has been raised and is deployed under that premise of we're going to be kind of the one risk threshold above where a commercial bank would be. We can price that in along the spectrum. If you go from debt, what would fit a commercial bank, to what kind of a majority equity, every one of those notches has a lot of money chasing it. So yeah, we try to have an understanding of where the debt market is at all times, because a cash flow loan, again, going back to how we've oriented the company, if we were in our client's shoes, knowing what we know, what right. would we want the outcome to be? We've had clients say, hey, I think I need to sell a minority part of my business to finance this acquisition. And we say, I think you can accomplish this with debt. It's just not the debt you're used to.
Right.
It's more expensive than your traditional, what you're sure. used to, right? You're used to a prime plus 2 or 3% right. or something like that. And a lot of times this is priced significantly higher, but it's cheaper than equity. And running through that math, you know, is a little bit challenging, because it debt can be a bad word in some, you know, business owners' minds.
And so we'll do engagements where we say, we think we know where the capital provider is, but we're going to check off all these boxes. We're going to talk with banks. We're going to talk with right. non-traditional banks. We're going to talk with mezzanine or junior capital. And we're going to talk with minority equity. And the market will tell us where this fits.
Yeah. And that's where I nerd out, because it's like, if you can optimize the capital stack there and, you know, you get the debt shield, right? But you deduct the interest. And then ultimately, you can make the company more valuable in the future when you do go to have that payday when you actually sell equity. So
I mean, that's the model. I mean, that's when we talk about the way a lot of our sellers sell, the way a lot of our buyers buy, they come in and they'll pay, use a $20 million enterprise valuation, for instance. $20 million, they'll use 50-50 equity and debt.
Yep.
So they're only bringing $10 million in equity to the table. The debt that they're putting on the business is typically provided by a non-traditional bank. It's right. based on cash flows of the business. It's priced 8 to 12% a lot of times. And there's a lot of lenders that will follow private equity to the moon. They will
yep.
they will support private equity as long as they need to. That nuance is also interesting for business owners who are selling a portion of their business. If you're selling 80% and you're rolling 20%, 20% of $20 million is $4 million. But when they use 50-50 debt, it's actually only $2 million right. that you're rolling. So you, as a seller, get the benefit of that debt as well. So there's just a lot of solutions out there that debt can really solve: management buyouts, growth capital.
Acquisition.
Yeah, that are not top of mind. But a lot of times we will steer clients that way because it's in their better interest,
right,
right than taking on maybe a traditional equity partner.
So a couple of questions left. Can you guys tell me about one of the favorite clients that you have worked with since Infinity Capital hung their shingle up in 2013?
That's a challenging question. What I've enjoyed most about our clients is that they're all different. We have worked with some, I'll call them characters, but they're I mean that in a loving way. We've also worked with some, you know, incredibly smart, focused, no frills, get the job done type clients. And I think I would be unfair to the rest of the clients if I picked one.
It's like saying which kid do you like best.
Yeah, it really is. But truthfully, that's the joy of what we get to do, is we get to play the role of psychiatrist at times, where yep. we're sitting next to someone who is going through this emotional roller coaster of selling a business, and they're talking about generational wealth. They're living on every new update of information, and we don't have the same skin in the game they do. We obviously have a fee riding on the outcome, and so we care, but we see the raw emotions, and a lot of times we have to sit with them or talk them down through, you know, a time where they feel like, hey, I've this is it, I'm done, I gotta turn this off, and we'll let them experience that, but then kind of try to come in with a, you know, coherent argument as to why that may not be the right move at the time. So it's a challenging aspect, but honestly, I think it's one of my favorite aspects.
Yeah, the people we get to work with, and We may work with some clients for 6 months. We may work with some clients for 2 years, but it's a relationship that's in a microwave, because we are in some cases with them for two straight months.
Right.
And having decision after decision and blood, sweat, and tears. And we're part counselor, part deal expert, part quarterback, whatever you want to call us. And every business owner we've worked with kind of is intimidated by the private equity and high finance. It should be the opposite, because what our clients do every day, we couldn't do. We've developed this niche and we're proud of this, but it's different than growing a manufacturing company that employs 150 people. We are honored we get to work with those business owners. It sounds cheesy and cliche, but we admire the hell out of our clients. And I think it just presents this joy that we get to work. It's not always easy, and there's contentious discussions, not probably dissimilar right. to the world you guys live in. It's something that, unless you would be in our shoes, you wouldn't understand kind of the roller coaster of a single engagement. The one that we worked yep. with together, it'd be interesting to hear his perspective on this, because every one of our clients kind of has this, you know, oh crap moment where they give up. They just, okay, I'm done. This is too hard. And we kind of have to bring them back from the abyss. And we've been kind of desensitized to it, and we help them offset that. But transactions are hard, and it's emotional. They're all kind of a miracle in itself that they get done, because so many things have to happen to go right. We get to know them really well, and we've just been really lucky to work with some really great people who have been above and beyond gracious to us and have referred clients to us, that I'd like to say that we've just been so good at our job that we've just worked with some really good people. Yeah.
We've been lucky.
Well, that's a great answer, but ultimately we're in the same business as you guys. Our business is giving advice to people, and at the end of the day, they get to decide if the fee they're paying is worth the value they're getting. And it's a testament to you guys that you've continued to grow. And I think it's wonderful that you guys are filling the need in the market. So if you've got a business and you're listening to this and you're thinking of a transaction, go hire the best people you can find to advise you on that transaction, is my advice.
That's yeah. amazing. Thank you for coming by, guys.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, guys. Honored.
Yeah.
All opinions expressed by the host and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Full Sail Capital. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. Clients of Full Sail may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast. If you enjoyed today's conversation, please review and subscribe through your preferred podcast platform. Have a great week.